All right, good morning. I'd like to call the House Education Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, April 19th. Let the record reflect the time is 8:14 a.m. Apologies for the late start time. Today we have present Representative McKay, Representative Prox, Representative McCormick, Representative Hemshute, Representative Story, and myself, Co-Chair Ruffridge. Co-Chair Allard is excused today. We have a quorum to conduct business. I would like to remind the committee members and those in the audience to please silence or turn off your cell phones. Staff assisting us today are Linda with House Records and Jake with the LIO, and our committee aide, my Chief of Staff, Bud Sexton, is back here to my right should you need anything. We have three items on the agenda today. We are going to return to House Bill 148 first, the Alaska Performance Scholarship. Then we will take up House Bill 139 and hear amendments, and it is my intent to move both House Bill 148 and 139 from committee today. And then House Bill 144, if time permits, we will have a first presentation for that. Any discussion on that topic? Seeing none. That brings us to House Bill 148, the Education Committee Bill for the APS Scholarship. We left off with this with a conceptual amendment on the floor from Representative Allard. Is there any motion from committee members on what to do with that?
I move Amendment 5.
Mr. Chairman, this is Representative McKay. I move to table Amendment 5.
Thank you, Representative McKay. I believe what we were working on before is Conceptual Amendment 1. Would you like to
address? I beg your pardon, yeah. Withdraw that motion, and I would move to table Conceptual Amendment Number 1.
Thank you, Representative McKay. Is there any objection to tabling Conceptual Amendment Number 1? Seeing none, which brings us back to House Bill 148 and hearing amendments. Is there a motion for other amendments?
I move Amendment 5.
Thank you, Representative Hemshute. And for the record, Amendment Number 5 is initially drafted by Representative Allard. Would you like to move Conceptual Amendment 5 from Representative Hemshute?
I absolutely would like to move Conceptual Amendment 5, Chair Rufford.
Thank you, Representative Hemshute. Is there any objection to Conceptual Amendment Number 5?
I object.
Thank you, Representative Hemshute. Could you please speak to what Conceptual Amendment 5 would be and give us a brief introduction?
I'm hoping that I understand the amendment correctly, and I think I do. What this amendment does is it opens the scholarship eligibility to students who either have a high score on the ACT or SAT or have a high GPA. So we're looking to provide as much flexibility to students to show their worthiness for this scholarship, and I think there are a couple of pathways to do that. I've known kids who cannot take a test to save their lives, and we have evidence from the McDowell study that requiring ACT or SAT is a barrier to students. But if we make it optional and allow also the GPA, which we know is a far better indicator of success in post-secondary, then we're just providing two pathways. And one of the barriers on the ACT and SAT was access to it. So by having a high GPA in a rural school, you know, you don't have to travel to take the SAT or the ACT. And then at the end of the day, we know that participation in the scholarship fell way off when the state stopped funding and providing for the SAT and the ACT. So we know that fewer students were taking those tests. So this just provides two pathways to the same end result of greater eligibility for the scholarship.
Thank you, Representative Hemshute. Representative Story, would you like to speak to your objection?
Thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge. I actually have a couple of questions. It has to do with a few things. Well, first of all, a couple of concerns which you might want to hear from the department. I'm just wondering, because one of the things about just going to the GPA and not having to deal with the test at all, no one would have to find test scores and in the districts and at the department. So it just kind of moved that step. So I was just wanting to check in and see. Hopefully that's not a problem, but just wanted to check in about that. And then when it says on page 2, line 30, delete academic, I don't understand why we would be deleting academic, remaining academic requirements. because we're not deleting any of the academic requirements. So I'm very confused by that.
Thank you, Representative Story. Representative Himshue.
Through the chair, I can't speak to the question about the academic. I had the same question, and my thinking on that was just that a requirement is a requirement, whether it's academic or otherwise. And so I don't know why it needs to be deleted. I think it could stay. I don't know that that really plays too much of a role in this. As far as the burden on, I guess I've just known too many kids who, like Rep. Allard explained, for whatever reason are low performers on their GPA but can pass a test. And why should they not also receive the performance scholarship? They're high performers when they're put to the test. So,
that's follow up.
Representative Story.
Yes, and there are, as we know, accountability measures in this. So when they do go to whatever post-secondary institution they pick, if they do not keep their grades up, then they will lose their scholarship. Or if their grades drop, then their scholarship level drops. So there, you know, is the incentive, because this is about encouraging our students to work hard, study hard, and it's about a rigor. So I would like to make a motion I move to keep academic on page 2, line 30, keep the word academic in the bill.
Thank you, Representative Story. Is there an objection to amending conceptual amendment 5 by deleting page 5 or page 1, line 15 and 16?
Object.
Thank you, Representative McCormick. Would you like to speak to that objection?
I feel like I'd like some explanation.
Thank you, Representative Story.
Thank you. I just feel that this is an academic, they are academic requirements, so I just feel it's important to keep that in there.
Thank you. And perhaps we could have Director Eford come up and I know Representative Story had a couple of questions regarding this conceptual amendment from Representative Himshute. And now we're discussing amendment to the conceptual amendment. So did you have any input for us, Director Eford?
Good morning, Chair Ruppridge and members of the committee. Thank you for having me today. For this, the conceptual amendment, the one piece I would like to just share that we do have data on, of course, from the report that each of you received, the 10-year look back, that we do know that the curriculum and the academic success on that curriculum really makes a difference for the students as they attend their post-secondary programs, and specifically with the university classes, they do not have to take remedial classes at the rate that other students that have not completed and been successful on an academic rigorous curriculum. However, keeping the curriculum and having an and or I think is doable. The department currently has to consider the scores. It would be an efficiency piece that if we could take away the score and just be considering, but we certainly are capable of doing the either or piece. I just don't have data at my fingertips that shows that having a specific standardized test score would replace or would be in, also provide or would be an outcome of success for those students. We do have the information about the curriculum piece.
Thank you for that information. Representative Story, did you have any other questions for Director Eifer?
Yes, follow up through the chair. Nice to see you, Director Eford. And again, as I'm looking this on page one of the bill, there's a section that says has the minimum GPA, grade point average.
Representative Story, if we could just get through the portion on the amendment to conceptual amendment 5, specifically this word academic for now, and then we'll keep Director Eford here. And that way my brain doesn't get fried trying to keep up. So
thank you. Thank you for reminding us through the chair that the academic piece is important.
Thank you, Representative Story. Other discussion or questions on Amendment 1 to Conceptual Amendment 5? Representative Himshut.
Hi, thank you, Chair Ruffridge, through the chair. Is it possible that because we're expanding this to include more CTE, that the word academic is no longer applicable? Or I'm kind of questioning the semantics here, but through the chair, would you say that CTE also requires the word academic or should not have the word academic either way?
Through the chair, Representative Himshut, there is still an academic and that curriculum requirement there. I'm not sure if you take out academic, if that affects that curriculum, because it is outlined in the bill. They still have, even for the CTE program, there is still a required curriculum to meet the APS eligibility on the curriculum side. I would point out that one of the original premises for the APS program, of course, was to increase academic excellence for our students and to help support their success in their post-secondary. So I don't think leaving it or taking it out really removes that academic curriculum that's already outlined in the program for the academic track or the CTE. However, I do like keeping academic because that was the premise behind the performance scholarship.
Thank you, Director Eford. Other questions or comments, Representative Story?
Yes, thank you through the chair. I have been reminded by many career and technical teachers that they are trying to say how rigorous CTE is right now for students. They have to have high reading, writing, math curriculums to go through all those technology books when you're doing auto mechanics, just so many things. And so they have always reminded me that they have high academic standards in their career and technical classes.
Thank you, Representative Story. Representative Himshut.
Thank you. I had a little bit further guidance here that removing the word academic was suggested by the legal department, because it's not necessary since the requirements are spelled out. Again, I like having it there for the reasons that have been named, and I'm not sure that it changes I don't think it's going to change anything if we keep it, and having the words in there I think might matter. So,
thank you, Representative Himshut.
I support the conceptual amendment to the conceptual amendment.
Excellent. Representative McCormick, do you maintain your objection?
I remove my objection. Thank you.
Is there any further objection to Amendment 1 to Conceptual Amendment 5? Conceptual Amendment 1 to Conceptual Amendment 5. All right. Seeing none, Conceptual Amendment 1 to Conceptual Amendment 5 has been adopted. Yes, Conceptual Amendment 1 on Conceptual Amendment 5 on page 1, line 15 and 16. We would be removing that language from the amendment.
No.
Okay. Which brings us back to Brief at Ease. We are back on record. Okay, we are back with Conceptual Amendment 5. Is there any further discussion on Conceptual Amendment 5, Representative Story?
Thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge. Through the chair, Director Eford, on the amendment on line 11, it says the department shall set by regulation minimal requirements based on a substantially similar standard for districts that do not assign grades. And I know before in this bill, sometimes we put the unit, we put the commission instead of the department, and it seems to, and even I'm wondering if it shouldn't be, is that the correct body that should be setting minimum requirements? And I don't remember this ever being in the bill before, that who is this referring to, substantially similar standards of that homeschool where they don't assign grades or?
Representative Story, this portion of conceptual amendment 5 is, if you notice in on the bill, page 2, lines 11 through 13, this language is already in statute. The amendment, the conceptual amendment is setting forth a repeal of this language.
Through the chair, it says delete all material and insert.
And insert, if you notice that that language is capitalized and bolded, indicating it would match the other sections as a repeal. We can take a brief at ease.
Thank you.
Record, Representative Story.
Thank you, Co-Chair. I've had my questions answered.
Thank you. Other questions or comments on Conceptual Amendment 5? Representative Himshue.
Thank you. Through the Chair, Director Eford, just to put my mind at ease, your understanding of this conceptual amendment, will it open the scholarship to a broader range of students?
Through the chair, Representative Henshoot, my interpretation of what this conceptual amendment is doing would, yes, open the scholarship opportunities to students that have taken the curriculum laid out in the current statute, but for some reason did not make a certain GPA, but they have been able then to make a certain score on the standardized test. Yes, that would open, in my opinion, that would open the scholarship up to some additional students.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director Eford. Other questions or comments? Seeing none, do you maintain your objection, Representative?
I remember my objection.
Thank you. Is there any further objection on conceptual amendment number 5? Okay, seeing none, conceptual amendment number 5 has been adopted. Which moves us to amendment number 6, which is from myself, so I will move amendment 6. Thank you, Representative McKay. This is essentially conforming changes at the request of the director and with Ledge Legal in order to ensure that, as Representative Himshute said earlier, that this bill has the most available students. So making sure that we cover all post-secondary institutions in the state rather than just university or colleges, and as well as some other language to conform to that. Do we need to take a brief at ease?
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. We are back on record. We are with amendment number 6. Everyone has had a chance to peruse it. We have an objection for discussion, and so we are open up for discussion. Discussion on amendment number 6, Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Ruffridge. Through the chair, Director Eford, on line 13 and 14 on page 1, in this subsection, full-time enrollment means enrollment in a course of study that is not less than 15 credits. I'm really concerned about that 15 credits. I know many of our students are non-traditional students, and they're working as well as going to school. And in prior discussions, I think we've had it that my understanding was that the commission set how many credits needed to be taken, and that it had said like 12. Anyway, if you could comment on how many credits has been full-time enrollment for this scholarship.
Through the chair, Representative Story, I believe, and I'm sorry, I'm looking through the current bill if it's here. This is talking about a full-time student, but there is also, the award is also available for a part-time student that would be less than the 15 hours. So there's a part-time award for APS and a full-time award for APS, which I think would cover your concern for students that are non-traditional, not able to attend a full-time program of 15 credits.
Follow-up? So if my memory serves me correct, then that student gets a portion of the scholarship, like half of the scholarship?
Through the chair, Representative Story, I believe that's correct, but I need to check with my staff that actually administer that to ensure I'm providing you the exact total of the scholarship that they would be eligible to receive.
Follow-up? By putting in this not less than 15 credits, is that putting parameters on it that the commission might need for flexibility?
Through the chair, I believe this is the way the program is currently set up for the full-time classes. I believe in regulation there's some further details around the credit numbers, but again, I would need to talk with my staff to ensure I have the exact numbers of credits and the exact total of the scholarship they would receive based on half-time or part-time or full-time.
To the co-chair and committee, to me, 12 credits also serves as full-time, 4 or 5. I think that's really a high... 15 is really a high amount, and I certainly think 4 classes could constitute full-time.
Thank you, Representative Story. Other discussion or conversation? Representative Himshute.
Through the chair, I have a question for Director Eford. The bill that we're looking at, 148, says 15 hours. This amendment says 15 hours. Does the original APS language say 15 hours, or is it 12? Because 12 is full-time for a Pell Grant or whatever else, so is 15 the standard?
Through the chair, Representative Himshute, I believe it is 15 credits. But again, I think there is also a reference to maybe the first year is a 12 credit. I believe there is an allowance for 12 credits for the first year under the performance scholarship regulations. But again, I would check and get that information back to the committee.
Thank you, Director Eford. Please.
I think my comment through the chair is that I almost feel like it's an overstep for us to decide what full-time is, and the commission could decide that, because if you're doing quarters versus semesters, that can also change what full-time is. I would be more comfortable somehow if there was a way to say full-time enrollment will be determined by the commission, but I'm not sure if that would place a burden on the commission that would be unwelcome. So I guess through the chair, Director Eford, am I barking up a bad tree here?
through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, again, the commission would work through regulations. I'm not sure if we would be working with an institution to determine what they would consider a full-time student that would complete within a certain number of years. I believe this is something that the commission could take on, but I would love to talk with staff to understand if there's an added administrative burden of some kind that would not be in our purview.
And just a reminder for the committee, this section we're talking about here is on page 4, starting on line 20, which is section 6. This amendment is changing the language on line 22 from full-time enrollment at a qualified university or college to full-time enrollment at a qualified post-secondary institution. That's really the change that's being made here. And this language on full-time enrollment is not indicative of the qualifications to receive the scholarship, but rather to talk through what enrollment is necessary to receive the step-up provision. So if you are enrolled full-time, and that is 15 credits or greater, and you have received a 3.5 GPA, you can qualify potentially for the step-up provision. So there's a slight difference here. I just wanted to make sure that that was clear for the record. Representative Story?
Could we have a brief at ease?
Please, brief at ease. Back on record, we have amendment number 6 before us. We have questions regarding the credit component. Representative Story, would you like to ask that question again for Director Eford and clarify?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Director Eford, if you could clarify what amount of credits is the actual in regulations, I'd appreciate it.
Through the chair, Representative Story, again, as I stated, I did confirm with staff for the first year for the award for full-time, it is 12 credits.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion on amendment number 6? Seeing none, Representative McKay, do you maintain your objection to amendment 6?
I withdraw my objection, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, is there any further objection to amendment number 6? Okay, seeing none, amendment number 6 has been adopted, which brings us to no further amendments that I have. Is there any other amendments to House Bill 148? All right, any further discussion on House Bill 148? Representative Story.
I just want to thank Director Eford for all her work, and I want to thank the Alaska Post-Secondary Commission, who has really wanted this modernization of the APS formula, and I thank the committee for taking over this as a and House Education Committee bill. I think it's really important to grow our workforce and to get our students some financial help in this day where whatever post-secondary institution you would like to attend, that there is, if you work hard, that there is definitely some support from the state. So thank you, everyone, for your hard work on this.
Thank you, Representative Story. Any other comments or questions? I would also like to thank Director Eford, and you had some closing comments.
Yes, Chair Ruffridge. I don't even think I put myself on the record this morning because I'm very excited about this bill. So, for the record, Santa Eford, Executive Director for the Commission on Post-Secondary Education, and I really want to echo what Representative Story has said. I cannot say thank you enough to this committee for your engagement, for your enthusiasm and concern for Alaskans. This is a priority for my commission, and they are very supportive, and I just appreciate the hard work that's gone into this, and I think it will make a huge difference for our students and for Alaska and our workforce. So thank you all for your work.
Absolutely, and thank you so much for your time being here for many committees through this process. So, Representative McCormick, what is the will of the committee?
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge. I motion to move House Bill number 148, version Bravo, also referred to as 33-LS0624/B, be advanced from the committee as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes, and authorize legislative legal to make technical and conforming changes as needed.
Thank you, Representative McCormick. Any objection? Seeing none, House Bill 148 moves from committee, and we will take a brief at ease to sign that paperwork. At ease. All right, we are back on record, House Education Committee. And next on our agenda is House Bill 139, Correspondence Study Program. We have been introduced to this bill and had invited testimony, public testimony, which brings us now to committee discussion and amendments. Is there a motion for any amendments?
Mr. Chairman, this is Rep. McKay. I withdraw Amendment 1.
Thank you, Representative McKay. Amendment number 1 has been withdrawn.
At ease.
At ease. All right, we are back on record. We are hearing amendments for House Bill 139. Is there a motion for Amendment number 2?
I'd like to move Amendment 2.
Thank you. I will object. Representative Hemshire.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Ruffridge. This amendment does two things. The first thing this amendment does in that top section, lines 1 through 7, is it does what the superintendents of the districts asking for this bill asked for. And I'll quote the letter I received from them in January. There's a whole long line here, but it ends with their request to multiply the ADM of the correspondence program by 90% plus a special needs funding factor of 1.2. And so that's what this amendment does. It takes the ADM at the 90% that they currently receive and then provides a multiplier of 1.2 as requested. So that's the first part. And then the second part sets a standard. I take so seriously our role as the sort of the middleman for the public dollar. And so when we spend the public dollar, I want to make sure that we're spending it wisely. And so I think accountability is a good thing. And the second part of this amendment sets some accountability standards on the correspondence programs so that when they receive this public funding, that they also show performance measures for the investment of those public dollars. That's what the amendment does.
Thank you, Representative Hemshute. And for the committee's information, we do have two folks online for questions should we need that. We have Chris Raytan from Craig City School District Superintendent and Connor Bell, Fiscal Analyst for Legislative Finance. Other comments or questions on Amendment number 2? Representative Story.
I would like to hear from Superintendent Raytan about, I know he was one of the superintendents who signed the original letter, and why they kept it at 0.9 and then the special needs factor. And then my other thing is the 96th percentile. Well, I understand wanting accountability. I believe that number, after discussion with the committee, should be lower, because I know right now their, I think, correspondence has been like in the 20s. I'm not sure, but I think that'd be too high of a jump. And I to 96, and there's some pretty significant accountability factors. So I don't know if 50%, I mean, a growth measure, but I'd like to hear the amendment's sponsors' thoughts on that.
May I speak to that?
Thank you, Representative Story. We will go to Representative Himshoot first and then to Mr. Raton.
Representative Story, if you look a little past the 96% on lines 14 and 15, it says, or the average participation rate of all district student assessment participation rates in the state, whichever is less. So if the building-based programs are reaching 80%, then the correspondence programs would also need to reach 80%. They also have a couple of years to reach that. It's not immediate. And so then they need to reach it and maintain it within a couple of years.
Thank
and
you.
I apologize for not bringing these amendments to you sooner. It's hard to read all of it at the table, and I'm learning how to do this, and I should have brought these to you sooner, so I apologize.
And then we will move to Mr. Raton, superintendent with the Craig City School District. If you could please introduce yourself for the record. And the question posed by Representative Story is in regards to the letter that was signed by, I think, yourself and a few others in regards to 90% plus special needs multiplier. And if you need that question repeated, we can do that.
Good morning. This is Chris Raton for the record, superintendent of Craig City School District. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you regarding HB 139, and in particular, the question regarding amendment number two. First, I would say, I would think all of the districts who operate homeschool programs, course science programs across the state would be pleased in regards to what the amendment is doing in regards to the 90% of the BSA plus the special needs factor. In the conversations that I've had for a number of years with the other districts that run statewide correspondence homeschool programs, we're just looking for equity in regards to providing the best services for our students who have disabilities and looking for a level playing field with brick and mortar schools. So that we're greatly appreciative. There is some concern that I have, as well as I could speak for many of the other districts that have statewide correspondence homeschool programs regarding the participation rate for district and statewide assessments. And I would just draw the committee's attention to Alaska Statute 14.03.016, which is a parent's right to direct the education of the parent's child. In that statute, it does say that a local school board shall, in consultation with parents, teachers, and school administrators, adopt policies to promote the involvement of parents in the school district's education program. The policies must include procedures of, one, recognizing an authority of a parent and allowing a parent to object to and withdraw the child from a standards-based assessment or test required by the state, and, two, recognizing the authority of a parent and allowing a parent to object to and withdraw the child from an activity, class, or program. And then we also then, as each district, have to adopt policies and how to make that work, you know, within our local context. And the second piece of this, the amendment number two, is kind of in direct opposition of Alaska Statute 14.03.016. And I think it would be very difficult for all school districts in regards to all school districts, especially those operating correspondence homeschool programs, to meet that standard. What I have heard from many of the parents in regards to my 12 years of being a superintendent over a district that has a statewide correspondence homeschool, as well as since 1997, when I was employed with Galena as IDEA first got started, was parents will say, hey, we know our kids the best. We understand where they are. We're developing an individual plan and consultation with the school district with our contact teacher to develop a plan that most appropriately meets our individual students' needs. We have ongoing assessment. We can attest to that in regards to work samples and those types of things that are provided to the district. And so I think there's assessment pieces that are in place, but what the second piece of Amendment 2 does puts districts in an awkward place in regards to how we thread that needle of providing all parents a right to direct the education of the parent's child, as indicated in the statute 14.03.016, as well as in regards to what Amendment 2 is trying to address. And I would just like to state finally that no school district is trying to shy away from accountability and those types of things. We're just trying to live into the best of our ability state statutes that have been put in place in previous administrations. Thank you for the opportunity to provide this information, and I'm open for any questions that committee members might have.
And thank you for being here and answering those questions. Representative Hemshue.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Superintendent Raitan. It's great to hear your voice. I wish I was in Craig. My question for you is, what is the federal assessment requirement? I know that there are federal requirements on the number of students who test, and I think Alaska falls short even of the federal requirement, but I don't know that number. Do you know that number?
95% is the federal requirement.
And in Amendment 2, there is a line. Thank you for that. I knew it was high, and I don't think Alaska meets that requirement because of our state provision allowing parents options, but it's a I think, a fair goal. In Amendment 2, Superintendent Raitan, it also says that the requirement is for a correspondence program must maintain a correspondence program student assessment participation rate of at least 96%, or the average participation rate of all district student assessment participation rates in the state, whichever is less. So taking the statewide average and applying that to correspondence schools, I'm just hesitating to invest the public's money in a program that doesn't meet the same standards as other programs. Can you help me with that?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Hemshue. I guess I would say that what's in place, and I can only speak to the correspondence homeschool programs that I worked with, but I would imagine the others are similar. There are other assessment items that are in place for families to utilize with their students in consultation with their contact teacher when they're developing the individual student learning plan. That is the backbone of the student individual learning plan for the correspondence homeschool programs. So there are assessment pieces in place. I would also, you know, other items that we track, you know, here specifically in Craig, as well as when we were in Galena, is the number of students who are accessing college university classes, who are graduating, you know, close to associate with an associate's degree, those types of things that aren't really addressed in here. Those are other assessment factors that we utilize to gauge how we're doing and where we can improve. And the other piece is also in regards to how we can continue improving that relationship. You know, there's really no magic in a correspondence homeschool program other than the relationship between the parent with their child and the relationship between the contact teacher and the district with that parent in regards to providing them the most robust access to curricular options and choices and flexibility to best meet their students' needs. And so I would say, you know, if you look across the state, one accountability measure is correspondence homeschool programs have been gaining enrollment. And there is a more of a movement towards that option for some families. And I think that's also a key part of our accountability in regards to how we're providing services, developing that the best customer service model that we can for each individual family we're working with. And our ever-growing enrollment that's been, you know, ongoing since the state of Alaska provided this option for families.
Thank you, Mr. Raitan. Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you, Chair Ruffridge. There's definitely two pieces to this amendment, the money itself and then the assessment. And I guess I'm mostly concerned about the assessment piece. A couple of reasons. One, it is logistically difficult for especially the statewide correspondence programs to arrange for these tests. I guess more importantly, when we talk to
brick-and-mortar school systems, for the lack of a better term. The standardized test results kind of indicate that Alaska, by and large, isn't meeting the standards. And then the response is, well, the standardized test isn't a good way to meet, to measure progress or performance anyway, which, to be honest, I'm starting to agree with. I think given the nationwide, that the one I'm thinking about is the nationwide NAEP. The highest performing school still has a very significant, we'll call it underperformance rate. And so it does appear, or a case could certainly be made, that the standardized test isn't a very effective measure, practical measure of performance. So we're asking school districts that have a logistical challenge in just getting everybody together in the same place to take the test. And then when they take the test, we are saying, well, that, all right, whatever the results are, they don't mean anything. So this, I guess I'm not too crazy about adopting the second part of this amendment for the, I'm not too enthused. I am crazy, but other sucks. Too enthused about this. I question the value of these tests. Everybody else, not everybody, many people seem to be questioning the value of the tests in the first place. So why would we ask districts to spend more money on tests we don't care about? Doesn't make sense.
Thank you, Representative Prox. Representative Himshue.
Thank you, through the chair. I just wanted to ask Superintendent Raitan one more question. Given your statements about all of the other measures of success for students, would you be willing to say that brick and mortar programs, building-based programs, also produce similar measures of success with their students not related to testing?
Through the chair, Representative Henshute, absolutely, I would. Statewide district assessments are one piece. They're a snapshot of one particular time in a student's life. Where I look for success is that when we have a student graduate from our system, that student has every option available to them, regardless of what they want to do. If they would choose to go to the military, that's an option. Directly into the university college, that's an option. Workforce, vocational training, whatever it is, our goal is to make sure that the student has every choice available to them to make the best choice for them as they transition into adulthood. I think that's the biggest factor in regards to how we can assess how well we're doing. And the other aspect of that is being strong, contributing members of their community and providing services back to the community.
Thank you.
Other comments or questions on Amendment 2, Representative Story?
Thank you. And then through the chair, this is to Superintendent Raitan. When we have provide special education services, as we are called to do by law with our individual education plan, when it is done through correspondence and it's say a parent had a grievance that it wasn't the district or the correspondent school was not meeting the intent of the IEP. Does that fall to the district or to the correspondent school to be liable for? I would think there are some kids in your district who go to Galena or IDEA. Is it Craig's responsibility to meet the IEP or the correspondence program?
Through the chair, Representative Story, it would be based on where that student is most enrolled, based on how the base student allocation and FTE is determined, is responsible for the individual education plan for students with disabilities. So, for example, we have students here in CREG who are partially enrolled in PACE correspondence program and partially enrolled in our brick and mortar schools. Based on the percent of where they're enrolled, that school then would be responsible for managing the individual education plan and working with the parent and the team to develop the best plan for that student. When we're looking at dual enrollment across the state, so for example, we have families and our students in Anchorage, the Mat-Su, across Southeast Alaska who are living in small communities who are enrolled with us. Depending on if they are dual enrolled with their community brick and mortar school and at what percent, would depend on who's responsible for the individual education plan. However, I would say that for all the students that we have where we're responsible for the individual education plan, we are then directly accountable for that plan.
Follow up?
Please.
Is that why the superintendents wanted to keep it at 0.9 and that not 1? Is because they have some responsibilities for their correspondence programs?
Through the chair, Representative Story, I would just say, you know, when we were having this discussion amongst the superintendents that signed the letter and then developed the resolutions, it's been going on for a number of years in regards to increasing special ed enrollment in our correspondence programs. How do we meet to the best of our ability that particular student's needs? And so in our discussions, we weren't trying to open up a can of worms by addressing the entire BSA formula. We were just looking at, because it was already set at 0.9, we were just looking at what would be equitable in regards to also receiving the 1.0 special needs factor. However, given that there's been some discussion about moving it to, 100% of the base student allocation, that would be even more helpful in regards to ensuring that we could develop the most robust educational plan for all of our students, but in particular our students with special needs.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments or questions? I do have a couple myself, but I will go to Representative Prox first.
Yeah, thank you. Through this, Jared, just the comment that the superintendent made about the secret sauce. I think that's important to really think about. What seems to make the correspondence programs work is a almost universal, like, yes, has to be universal at some point, contact and discussion between the teacher, the contact teacher, they call it, and the parents. Parents are involved. And the parents end up doing quite a bit of the work kind of under the guidance of the teacher. And the other advantage of this correspondence programs is the ability to structure the content, the curriculum, to the individual student. And every student is unique. And the challenge of doing it in every assembling 30 students, well, in a classroom, if they just have one, but across the district, they try to fit square pegs, triangular pegs, octagonal pegs into one round hole. And that is very difficult to do. And that's, again, I think what we should focus on, that advantage that they have. And then there's much less need for standardized testing and centralized accountability. So my recommendation would be to vote down Amendment 2, and then there's one coming up, Amendment 3, addresses the first part of Amendment 2. So I'd recommend that we, with respect to the maker, vote down Amendment 2 and focus on Amendment 3.
Thank you. Representative Hemshire.
Chair Ruffridge, will Superintendent Raitone be with us on Amendment 3 as well? I had one more question. I could ask it now, or it was more directed to Amendment 3.
Thank you, Representative Hemshute. I do want to be cognizant of time today. We do have folks here for the introduction of House Bill 144. It is clear we will not make it through all amendments today. So if Mr. Raitone can be with us again when we take this bill up at a later date, we will have to move some of these amendments at a later time. So I don't know if that answers your question or not. Would you like to ask Mr. Raitan your question now?
That would be wonderful.
Please.
Thank you. Through the chair, Superintendent Raitan. My last question is, we had a lot of testifiers from the IDEA program, and I know that you know it well, having previously been in Galena. There are 7 special ed teachers in the IDEA program, and you had discussed with me that about 10% of kids require an IEP. So if I apply those numbers to the IDEA program, 6,000 kids times 10% gives us 600 kids, 7 teachers. That's a ratio of roughly 86-1. In brick-and-mortar schools, special ed teachers generally have a ratio of 10-15-1, unless it's intensive needs. That's a whole different thing. But at a ratio of 86-1, is it possible to meet the federal mandates surrounding special education? What is your ratio in Craig of special ed teachers to IEP students?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshute, I'll address your question from my experience when I was the superintendent in Galena with IDEA and how we looked from a staffing perspective first, and then I will address it from a Craig City School District perspective. When I was in Galena, we would look at for our IDEA students with special needs, a 1-to-60 max student teacher ratio with our special need teachers managing the IEP and developing a schedule for services through speech paths, occupational therapists, physical therapists, those types of things who would then come into our different offices, work with the parents as well as in the student to develop that program. We learned there that was about the max of what we could do in regards to really managing the IEPs well. And those types of things. And the reason it's a little bit higher there is because our special ed teachers don't have the daily responsibility of also doing the instruction for the students. They're working through the parents for that instruction. And Craig, I will tell you, we were 436 FTE students in PACE after the October count period with 46 students who have special needs that we are managing IEPs. We have one special ed teacher who is managing that right now. And I would say for us in regards to our size, and how we're developed, that's about at the limit of what we can do. So I would imagine, I can't speak for the districts, but if this HB 139 goes through, we'd be looking at, in a very difficult time, to find really high quality special ed teachers, increasing the amount of services that we have for those families.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Story.
Up through the chair, this is just a comment. I think the ratio that you said of 1 to 15 is very excellent ratio, and the Juneau school districts did not hit near that ratio in their public schools, and it is really hard to find special education teachers, and we spend a lot of contract money for OTs and speech therapists because we just don't have them, so they come up and it's actually a lot more expensive to have the contract. We wish we could hire people, but there's really a shortage of special ed teachers.
Thank you, Representative Story. All right, seeing no further discussion, I will give my couple of comments. I agree with Representative Prox on this issue. I think that we can take up Amendment 3 and discuss the funding component, but the section of Amendment 2 with respect to the maker of the amendment certainly adds a burden that in many cases is in direct contradiction to our current statute regarding the right of a parent to choose to participate in a test or not. And until we're ready to address that as an entire subject on its own, putting it into this bill with this amendment is probably the wrong place to do that. So I will not be supporting amendment number 2. That being said, I will maintain my objection. And if you do not mind, Linda, we will call a roll.
Representative McCormick?
Yes.
Representative McKay?
No.
Representative Hemshue?
Yes.
Representative Story?
No.
Representative Prox?
No.
Co-Chair Allard is not here. Co-Chair Ruffridge?
No.
That's two yeas and four nays.
With a vote of two yeas and four nays, amendment number two has failed to be adopted. And at this time, I will set aside House Bill 139, and we will leave amendment number three through amendment number eight for another day. And we will take a brief at ease while we transition to the introduction of HB 144, Education Tax Credit. Brief at ease. We are back on record, 9:31, House Education Committee. I have invited my Chief of Staff, Bud Sexton, to the table to give us a brief introduction to House Bill 144, and then we will hear briefly from Chad Hutchinson, bowler extraordinaire with the University of Alaska. And then we also have Megan, I think it's Ryby. I probably mispronounced that online as well. Mr. Sexton, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Ruffridge. For the record, Bud Sexton, I'm staff to Representative Ruffridge. Pleasure to introduce to you HB 144 today, which is the Education Tax Credit Program. Very simply, first off, let me give you a little background on the Education Tax Program. First established in 1987 by the legislature, and the goal is to encourage businesses, private businesses, to make charitable contributions to schools across Alaska. These are the different entities that qualify for the current Education Tax Credit Program. 2 4-year colleges, facilities, instruction, research, educational support purposes. Donations can be to a school district or a technical or training school for vocational education programs and facilities, and also available for Alaska Native cultural or heritage programs for staff and students and facilities as well. So serves a broad range of potential possibilities in the areas of which private companies can make donations. A little bit of history, at least recent history. In 2014, House Bill 278 expanded the list of eligible recipients for donations, and most recently in 2018 did establish the ability for equipment to be added as what could be donated to these institutions. And as mentioned, since this program started in 1987, it has been extended periodically since that time. Most recently, was House Bill 223, which established the current sunset date of December 31st, 2024. And you'll see some entities talk about effective date being January 1st, 2025, essentially the same thing. Program expires at the end of 24. These are the various income taxes at the state level, which can be offset by the Education Tax Credit Program. So as you'll see, and I believe it was fisheries and mining that was expanded most recently. So a lot of potential for different businesses and entities to be able to make their contributions. This is a busy slide, so I'll try to walk you through this. Through the Division of Revenue, Tax Division, these are available online. And so what these encompass is showing you from 2011 up to 2022. And I'm working right to left as I describe this. So the credits claimed, so that's the amount that has impacted our state budget. And then the total of contributions, that column represents the far right four columns. So if you add in the U of A, the APU, secondary vocational, and the other, those total of those numbers equal the total of contributions. And then depending on the year, depends on how much can be percentage can be claimed for the tax credit. So that's where you get the claim against the state. So as you look at 2022, the most recent full year for which we have the ability to look at, $2.3 million approximately was claimed as far as credits go. And we can see a very large amount of impact and benefit for all of the schools across Alaska, totally nearly $100 million, $97.9 million since 2011. 223, again, is the current legislation regarding education tax credits. And so this gives you an example of what changes over the last three years, where they reduced that. If you look in that middle column, that 100 to 300,000. So let me explain this for you. So up to 100,000, I'm going to take the 2018. If you contributed up to 100,000, you could claim 50% of those against for the education tax credit. And the 100 to 300, you could also claim 100% of those, and then greater than 300,000 for contributions, again, it dropped to that 50%. And there was a $5 million cap that you could claim against credits or against taxes. And then in 2019, that middle column, the 100 to 300 was reduced to 75%. And then in 2021, it was further reduced to the 50%. So you can see in 2021, no matter what amount you were donating, the credits claimed was at the 50 percentile, and then a 1 million credit against your taxes.
And if we could pause there, we do have a question from Representative Crocks.
Thank you. Through the chair, it appears that there's a strong correlation between, which I suppose was the idea, but there's a strong correlation between the reduction in the amount and the percentage that you could claim from, going back to the previous slide, from 2008 going back up to 2022, is a noticeable reduction in the amount of contributions. Did you notice that as well, or am I seeing something that isn't there?
For the record, Bud Sexton, staff to Representative Reference, through the chair to Representative Prax. To be able to answer that question, I can look at this figure here in the summary total. I also want to make mention that we do have Director of the Tax Division, Colleen Glover, who should be online to be able to answer any specific questions through the LIO number. And so to your question, very broadly speaking, obviously there are years where the amount of donations are quite significant compared to other years. Whether those are a direct reflection of the tax breaks in that particular year, it's hard for me to be able to suggest one way or the other on that.
Representative Hemshue.
A column that I would like to see on here, and maybe it's not possible, is how many organizations made use, so like how many total donors by year. Is that knowable?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshute, I did ask a question, and they don't have specific numbers, a division of revenue for various entities. It's not made public for one reason or another.
Thank you. Please continue.
So House Bill 144 is looking to remove the sunset date for the education tax credit. Again, it's been in existence since 1987 and has been successfully extended throughout time. And it's shown to be an asset for our different educational institutions. And removing the sunset provision also allows various companies to further plan out their donations over a systematic basis. Again, since equipment and other things are available to be donated, we know with depreciation schedules and such, being able to plan out farther ahead and give different foundations, different schools, really gives them the ability to plan farther out in their purposes as well. We believe that by having the levels consistent with the 2021, that it is reasonable for the level of deductions from against our state budget and still maintaining the cap of 1 million. So it still provides a benefit to all the schools and foundations across Alaska while limiting the impact to our state. So at this point, Chair, that's the end of my comments. And if anyone has any further for me, or welcome up Mr. Hutchinson.
Yes, thank you. Representative Story.
Thank you, through the chair, Mr. Saxon. Thank you for your work on this. Did you have a chance to survey the districts and find out if different entities were donating to them at the different levels? And why I ask that is I had a visit from a district. It wasn't this year, but last year, and they had asked for this level to go back up, that they had noticed a significant decline from a couple of their entities who were donating when the, I don't know if it was the percentages or the cap was changed. So my question is, have you had a chance to ask in many districts about this?
Through the chair, Representative Story, Bud Sexton, staff to reference for the record, Representative Reference. I have not spoken with a large amount of districts. I have spoken with a couple, and it was very broadly speaking to some of the programs which are receiving funding to be able to help offset. To your point, there are certain years, if you look at the slides in most recent 2021 and 20, and it, so there is a significant impact. So it is related to perhaps one aspect might be the percentage. It might just be the year. It might just be a combination of things. So it's a challenge to, I think, to pinpoint any one particular causal or correlative factor, I guess, is the question.
Hello.
Please.
Yes, and it's another question through the chair. On page 3, when it says donations for Alaska Native cultural or heritage programs for public school staff and students and a facility in the state that qualifies as a coastal ecosystem learning center, I'm wondering if this language is too narrowing. We have, like, for example, we have the Alaska Heritage Arts Campus here where they are doing a lot of art classes. And it's not focused on K through 12, even though K through 12 students, I guess, if, could take some. So maybe that does qualify them. But if they did not, and it was just university level classes at all, do they qualify? Same with Clinkett and Haida has a technology school here. Do they qualify for these tax credits?
Through the chair, Representative Story, Bud Sexton for Representative Ruffridge. I point you to the second bullet point on this slide, which does talk about a school district, state-operated technical and training school for vocational education courses, programs, facilities. Whether that specific entity does qualify, if Director Glover is on, or we could get that information, or we could reach out to the school to figure out if they do qualify. I don't have that answer at this time.
Thank you to the chair. Maybe we should be adding tribal schools to this language.
Thank you, Representative Story. And just from myself as the sponsor for this bill, the purpose behind this was exclusively to extend and eliminate the sunset date. So some of these more detailed aspects we can certainly dig into if that is the will of the committee as well. So thank you, Representative Story.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sexton. We will transition to Mr. Hutchison from the University of Alaska. It's a brief presentation on tax credits from the university perspective. And welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Rep. Ruffridge. For the record, my name is Chad Hutchison. I'm the State Director of Government Relations for the University of Alaska. With me online today, I have our Associate Vice President for Development at the UA Foundation, Megan Reavy, and she will be my lifeline if there's any complex questions. The university, thanks, Representative Ruffridge, for bringing this bill forward. It's a very important topic for the University of Alaska, and we support the bill as it is written at this point in time, and we're certainly open to suggestion if there is further refinements that the committee wants to make. But we do agree that if stability is a good thing, and if there is elimination of the sunset, we would be in support of that. So moving forward, that is our position. Education tax credit program is important to the university, and the biggest focus is workforce, future workforce. You see in this picture here, this is up in Fairbanks. This was a $1 million check. Coincidentally, that's the cap for the education tax credit, so draw your own conclusions if there's a connection. This is from Kinross Mining Company. This is for our Trotheta, so cultural native studies. Up in Fairbanks, you see representatives from Kinross. There's Chancellor White, our vice president of rural campuses, Charlene Stern, and representatives of Doyon. So we're very pleased that this partnership has worked well with our private third-party interests, and it is a popular program, there's no doubt. To answer Representative Himshute's question from earlier, we average about anywhere from 20 to 30 participants. That that's in recent years. It was actually higher. It is true when the cap amount was $5 million as opposed to $1 million, and when there's a phased approach prior, there were more participants. And of course, the economy of Alaska matters too. When the economy is doing well, and there's depending factors on what the workforce is, and then there's also the balance that we have with state treasury, which is why some of the changes occurred back in 2018. Those are all these different things that have to be considered whenever you think about tax credits generally, and in particular the education tax credit itself. This builds off of what Mr. Sexton was saying. This is our most recent year. There you see the university, $2.5 million. The total contributions, $4.6 million. There's the credit claims for the state, corporate net income tax, fisheries, mining, et cetera. So we're very pleased to get any funds. But it is true that there has been a general decline as the years have gone on post-2018. Sometimes there is some variance, but there has been that general decline. Here's just some of the companies that take advantage of this. And cash and equipment, it's used in a directed way. It can be used for our program. So if there's a mining program in the interior or at UAA or at UAS, and they want to donate equipment for those students to learn in a very real way as they think about their future careers at Pogo or Fort Knox or Greens Creek, that has certainly happened. You see Alaska Airlines is there. We have aviation programs. There's a wide berth, commercial fishing, very supportive in the sense that, especially in research, there's been donations. So there's a wide variety of applications. The education tax credit itself is a pretty broad, all-encompassing focus, and so the university itself has been a good beneficiary of those dollars, and we put them to work. We try to make sure that we're focusing on workforce or focus on relevant research that helps private industry and our economy in Alaska. So it's a program that works well, I think, and we're very appreciative that there's consideration about eliminating the sunset, because that would allow for stability for the third parties. So with that, I want to keep it brief. I know we have time for him today, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Hutchison. Are there questions for the university? Look at that. You are going to get off easy today. Thank you for being here, and thank you to Megan Reeby for being here as well. And that is our introduction to House Bill 144. Is there any comments or questions from committee members on this before we set it aside? And Representative Brox.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think your comment earlier about the objective of House Bill 144 is to extend the expiration date of the tax credits. That is the most important thing, I think, and we can debate the details next year. But we don't want to get too far down on the weeds to impede the main objective of the bill. And then when we do get down in the weeds, we got to think about the core thing is that we conceptually are dedicating revenue through a tax credit. Otherwise, it would go to the general fund. There is somewhat of a legal challenge to that if somebody wanted to do it, but I'm in favor of the tax credits because it does put the decision down towards the individual level, or in this case, at least the corporate level, of somebody being able to contribute to something they actually want, and reduces the number of things we have to argue about, which is a good thing.
Thank you, Representative Prox.
Welcome.
Representative Story.
Thank you to the committee and to Rep. Prox. I see that definitely, you know, in extending the education tax credits is, you know, very important. And but I do think that there have been some other entities, particularly tribal entities, who are offering some good educational programs that different groups might want to contribute and use these tax credits. And I don't think it would be that hard to just add that language in there if, you know, I'll look into it more and maybe bring some information next time. But anyway, I appreciate your comments.
Thank you, Representative Story. And for the good of the committee, we are going to take up House Bill 144 again on Friday. We did have public testimony scheduled for this as well, for that. And I do want to set an amendment deadline for this. So be considering those thoughts. And that will be next Wednesday, April 25th at noon. So we do have about a week or so to consider what that will look like. Appreciate your diligence and attention to the issues today and working through some challenges with the bills. Brief eddies. Record. Yes, appreciate your time and diligence to the committee today and to the process today. And seeing that there is no other business before the Education Committee at 9:53 a.m., we will be adjourned.